This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Welcome to the show. In Washington, D.C. today, President-elect Trump's choice for attorney general said he has no reason to doubt, that's the quote, has no reason to doubt, the conclusion of U.S. intelligence agencies that connected Russia's president directly to the hacking of Democratic accounts during the election campaign. This is Senator Jeff Sessions being asked today about the hacking and more at his confirmation hearing. Sessions also said today he does not support a ban on Muslims entering the United States. Now, Washington State is watching today's confirmation hearing with special interest for a couple of reasons. For one thing, says the Puget Sound Business Journal's Greg Lamb, an attorney general, Jeff Sessions, could derail our state's marijuana industry.
He thinks that marijuana is very dangerous. You know, a lot of people, despite the fact that it's been legalized in 28 states and in Washington, D.C., there's a lot of people like Sessions who still believe that it's a gateway drug, that it leads to other drugs.
And what does he want to do to these 28 states in D.C. with legal pot?
Well, he hasn't stated it directly, but there's a lot of things he could do. He could immediately crack down on the legal dispensaries in Washington, D.C. He could send in agents to shut those down, and that certainly would send a signal that would be heard in Washington and other states. You know, that would discourage investment, could discourage business startups. You know, it really would take the wind out of the sails of the industry.
Is this, this must be so uncertain for Washington's pot growers and distributors and sellers and everybody to listen to this. Are they doing anything different or just losing sleep?
Well, that's a good question. I think they're losing sleep. There's obviously a lot of, chatter on social media. And, you know, the industry has staged some sit-ins, and I think they've been mailing some legal marijuana to Sessions' office on Capitol Hill and those kinds of things.
Do you think Sessions could or would absolutely just shut down, make, in effect, marijuana illegal because the federal government's not putting up with it at all? What would that look like?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. You know, one of the things that flies in the face of is the whole debate about states' rights. You know, Trump and Sessions have both spoken, in favor of states' rights. So they'd be going up against that if they really wanted to have a heavy hand and, crack down. But you know, there's, like I said, there's things in D.C. D.C.'s a federal city, and, it's been legal there. And, some members of Congress have just never been happy that the voters in D.C. have legalized marijuana. So, that could sort of be the first thing they could do. And, again, that would send a big signal. You know, if I were in the industry, if I were a grower or a retailer, I would certainly be paying attention to that if he were to do that.
The new prohibition, pot speakeasies in Pasco and Soto.
That's right. Well, speaking of prohibition, I was talking to somebody earlier, and the liquor flew pretty good in Seattle during prohibition. I think one of the largest businesses on the waterfront was involved with, let's just say, importing, Canadian whiskey. So, the new prohibition, we already know what that looks like, right? I mean, so it could be a return to that, I guess.
Right. We've been there before, and mm-hmm. the leaves will burn. Well, let's shift gears now, Greg, talking with the Puget Sound Business Journal's digital editor, Greg Lamb. You also wrote about another important issue to Washington, which is immigration. You have Microsoft and Amazon and other tech companies in town who employ a lot of foreign workers. And why would Attorney General Jeff Sessions want to block that?
Well, Jeff Sessions, like a lot of people in Congress, he's been outspoken against illegal immigration. And there's also, a lot of people who have been critical of the visa program that allows tech companies like Microsoft to bring in foreign workers. They've been critical of that because they see these jobs going to foreign guest workers instead of U.S. citizens.
Well, Trump has called the H-1B visa a cheap labor program. Do these foreign employees work for less money than American-born workers do?
They sometimes do, yes. And we've reported on that before. They sometimes do.
How concerned, then, are our local tech companies about this AG, Attorney General nominee, opposing H-1B visas?
Well, I think they're concerned. It was just this summer that Bill Gates was on Capitol Hill lobbying to expand the program. Obviously that's important to companies like Microsoft. And at the time, Sessions, it was before a committee on immigration that Sessions is a member of, and he was highly critical of Microsoft and called out Bill Gates, you know, for his lobbying efforts. So, you know, it's a contentious point right now, you know, between the Trump administration and, you know, the tech industry.
So overall, Greg, do you think that you're the Puget Sound Business Journal? Do you think that the business community in Washington State is overall nervous as they watch these Jeff Sessions confirmation hearings?
Well, certainly the tech industry and the legal marijuana industry, and I think overall in general, there's a concern in Washington State about the overall, you know, message that Donald Trump has been signaling since he was elected, and, you know, that goes right to the heart of, you know, our economy here. You know, if we're talking about trade, if we're talking about, you know, open borders, if we're talking about, trade with China, he's specifically called out companies like Amazon and Jeff Bezos and Boeing. So I think in general terms, there is a lot of concern. We're one of the areas where the economy is booming, and, you know, that's a sort of a uneven look as far as the recovery from the Great Recession, and we're one of the areas that seems to be prospering. And I think there is a lot of concern that, you know, the Trump administration could put some brakes on that.
Greg Lamb, digital editor for the Puget Sound Business Journal, talking about confirmation hearings for Attorney General choice Jeff Sessions today in the U.S. Senate. And there's so much to talk about right now with this incoming administration today. We're going to talk more about the Jeff Sessions hearings on All Things Considered this afternoon. Also, retired Marine Corps General John Kelly faced senators today. He is Trump's choice to lead the Department of Homeland Security. You had the heads of the U.S. intelligence agencies appearing before the Senate today, discussing their finding that Vladimir Putin ordered cyber mischief to disrupt our presidential election. And you have the ties of Donald Trump's son-in-law. All of that and more coming up later this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Soon after the election, Mayor Ed Murray reaffirmed that Seattle is a sanctuary city, which means that people who seek government services here in the city are not going to be asked about their immigration status. Well, long before the city's commitment, churches advocated for undocumented immigrants. From KUOW's immigration team, Ruby DeLuna reports that Seattle churches were at the forefront in the 1980s, helping refugees from Central America.
Before Seattle was a sanctuary city, there was the sanctuary movement.
My name is Carlos Amaya. I am from El Salvador.
Carlos Mejia is 68 years old. He and his wife came to Seattle in 1983. El Salvador was in the midst of a civil war. At the time, Mejia was a farmer and a part-time tailor. He was active in his church.
I was a church volunteer. We call catechist.
But his church activities raised suspicion from the government, especially the military. Speaking through an interpreter, Mejia says he feared for his life.
Exactamente, porque en realidad mucha gente murió inocentemente.
Because many innocent people died.
People were tortured and killed, he says. Mejia fled El Salvador. He ended up in Los Angeles. That's where he met the pastor of University Baptist Church at the time. He invited Mejia and his wife to stay at his church in Seattle.
These are the stairs that we go up and down every day.
We're in the space that used to be University Baptist Church. We reached the third floor. Inside, there's a kitchenette, a table, some chairs. Windows look out to the neighborhood. Mejia leads us to the room where he and his wife stayed.
We would
sleep. We slept in this room.
His wife was 7 months pregnant when they arrived. 2 months later, she gave birth to a boy in this very room, just like Mary and Joseph, says Mejia.
No teníamos donde ir.
We didn't have a place to go.
Sí, yo estaba sin trabajo, yo estaba
I had no work.
Con temor a la migración.
I was afraid of immigration.
Sí. Entonces hubo, pero fue una gran oportunidad
porque
creció el movimiento santuario.
Because the sanctuary movement grew.
Mejia and his wife were in hiding, but he was also speaking at local churches about the political turmoil in his home country.
I feel something in my heart to explain to the United States people, understand what happened in El Salvador.
But telling their story had its risks.
There was a sense that you were being watched.
That's Margie Payton. At the time, she was the church organist and was active in the sanctuary movement.
We never knew who was going to be in an audience where they were speaking. So we took every precaution to have people with them.
Payton says they didn't know if immigration would take them. So church members took turns to chaperone them. They took them to the store or to their appointments. They provided food and moral support. But not everyone agreed with the church's political stance.
Our government, the U.S. government, felt that what we were doing was illegal because they felt that they were fleeing for economic reasons as opposed to political reasons.
And some people didn't like what the church was doing. The church was vandalized more than once.
There was a time when barbells were thrown through the stained glass windows, and we took those barbells and put them on the church altar as a symbol of our stand as well.
Payton says it was an exhausting time, but they felt energized.
For me and for many people, we're living the gospel. This is what we're doing, and we're doing it because our faith says do it.
The church took its action to City Hall. It petitioned the council to pass a resolution in support of Central American refugees. In 1986, council members adopted the motion and declared Seattle a city of refuge. It would set the stage for future forms of immigrant protections.
We have to go down one more.
Back at the church, Carlos Mejia shows us the basement where his wife prepared food to share.
Over there,
era donde mi esposa hacía las tortillas.
Where my wife would prepare the tortillas.
Y preparaba comida y a veces compartía.
And she would prepare the food and sometimes we would share it
a los servicios
with the people who came to the services.
Mejia and his family stayed on for about 7 months. He had hoped to return to El Salvador once the political situation changed, but the family started to set down roots in Seattle. Mejia worked as a custodian at the University of Washington. Today, he's retired, but keeps busy with his gardening business. He has 3 children.
Afortunadamente, ya los tres están casados.
Fortunately, the 3 of them are now married.
Estamos esperando los grandchildren.
And so we're waiting for our grandchildren.
In 1992, Mejia became a naturalized citizen. Looking back to his early years in Seattle, he recalls his time at University Baptist Church as a beautiful history. It was an opportunity to tell the American people their story.
And the other thing was the feeling of happiness at the warm welcome that we received from these such very kind people.
From that moment on, he says, they felt free. Mejia says people who leave their countries leave with the hope of achieving a better life. You don't know where you're going to finish up or how you're going to be received. You don't know if you're going to survive. You don't know if you're going to return. I'm Ruby DeLuna, KUOW News.
That story was from KUOW's immigration team. In the next few months, we are going to look at the impact of the Trump administration on the lives of immigrants in Seattle and the Puget Sound region. Yesterday, the Burien City Council voted to become a so-called sanctuary city. If you have a story idea for us, please let us know at our website, KUOW.org. And finally, as President Obama's term heads into history, you can listen to the president's farewell address tonight. KUOW will bring it to you live at 6 o'clock tonight, 6 o'clock Seattle time. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Alyssa Washoda had always thought of Seattle as a beautiful city. And then she spent her summer in the control tower on top of the Fremont Bridge. It was part of the city's writer-in-residence program. And the more Washota looked at the Lake Washington Ship Canal, the less charmingly beautiful she found it.
The first thing that I saw was that, you know, it's not a river with riverbanks. There are human-made boundaries to the water. There are human-made boundaries between the water and the land, and they're very obviously demarcated. The next thing that I noticed was the trees. That is one of the things that makes the ship canal view from the tower so beautiful to me, that it's tree-lined. But my assumption is that probably almost all of the trees that I was looking at are non-native species.
Mm-hmm.
And the more that I researched the ship canal, the more I learned about why it was created, how it was created. And I started thinking about the process of dredging and the way that the water came in to fill that. And immediately Lake Washington's water level dropped about 9 feet. And then slowly over a little bit of time, it dropped 20 feet. The Black River dried up. And so my, you know, gazing out upon the ship canal began to be sort of imbued with all of these thoughts about the destruction that had happened, the displacement of Duwamish people, Duwamish villages that had been along the Black River that happened as a result of the creation of the ship canal.
And yet it came to you that, you know, I've just been told over and over that the ship canal is beautiful.
It was partly that I'd been told that. It was partly that I know that my sort of process of being a colonized individual and having a colonized consciousness makes me assess things as beautiful in a certain way.
Will you say more about, you said, you used the phrase that you have a colonized consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
I am a Native person. I am a member of the Cowlitz Indian tribe from southwestern Washington. My whole life I have been living in the United States, which is a settler nation that was built upon indigenous nations. And I wasn't raised on a reservation. I wasn't raised in a place that was wholly native. I was raised quite far from my tribe. And so although my mother is native and I was raised by my mother and my father, I was taught by both of them, and I was taught by the schools in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. I was taught by the people around me there. So I was taught by a lot of non-native people as well as some native people. All of my learning, no matter who it was from, was influenced by the fact that we had all been born in the settler state.
And that ship canal is of a piece with a settler state. Dominated and subjugated and channeled and regraded, mm-hmm, place.
When white people came to the place that's now Seattle, they found a land that was a horrible place to build a city in a lot of ways.
Right.
There were a lot of steep hills. There were tide flats. There were rivers that flooded the riverbanks. And people who had been living here since the beginning of time knew exactly what to do with that landscape. They knew exactly how to live here. They had seasonal rounds of gathering and fishing and hunting. They had figured out how to live on this land and with this land a very long time ago and were very good at it. And the settlers came and saw a landscape that had some things going for it, some things that could help them achieve their goals of wealth. But they felt that the land needed to be changed. And so they set about changing it. They regraded the hills. They took the hills down from some of their steepness to what they are now. They created the ship canal so that they could have a channel that would be of use to them in their commercial needs. And, you know, they created this canal because they wanted to dry up the Black River. They wanted the water level to drop in Lake Washington, for the Black River to dry up, and for the flooding to stop so that they could use that land and turn it into real estate.
As you spent your summer in the tower of the Fremont Bridge looking at the ship canal, did you think about the connection between your colonized mind and our colonized land?
While I was up there in the office this summer, I was thinking a lot about the connection between the colonized land and my colonized mind. And something that came up in my thinking and in my writing project is my refusal to accept impermanence. And I was writing about a breakup that happened this summer and the ending of a relationship over the summer and how much I was fighting that internally because I just wanted to find my forever partner. I just wanted this relationship to be set. I wanted to know exactly who I was going to be with so we could make our forever plans for our forever house and our forever life. And one of the biggest threats to me during that breakup was the idea of losing that dream of permanence. And I wrote a lot about that, and I thought a lot about that, that I was wondering whether that refusal to accept impermanence was part of my psychological colonization in a way, that my ancestors participated in a seasonal round. They moved around. They related to one another probably differently than I relate to people. And I wondered how much my desire to have that house and to know where I was living and what I was going to do with my life forever and who I was going to be with, that came to me pretty strongly as somewhat related in some way to this desire to set the landscape forever so that it would never change, so that there would never be a Black River to flood in the spring, so that there would never be tide flats to flood, so that the landscape would always be basically the same.
So, Alyssa, you're sitting up there in a perch in the Fremont Bridge, and how do you come to terms with how much was lost in Seattle and how much you appreciate Seattle? Like, what's the consciousness that you want to, what do you want to see when you look at that ship canal?
I was thinking a lot about the people who are still here, the ways in which the land was changed and things were lost for those people, and what my part is in it. I think I knew from the outset that I felt that because I use the bridges, because I live on this land, I am complicit in that colonization. I take part in it. I benefit from it. And I felt that it was my job as a writer, as a researcher, to find out as much as I could about the places that I love. Like the Arboretum, Foster Island used to be a place for sky burials, and that was outlawed by the settlers. There are other places in what's now Seattle that were also places for sky burials. And so the more I researched the place, the more I learned about specific notes of importance throughout the city.
Yeah, when I see people in Seattle applauding the protest at Standing Rock, for example, in Dakota, I sometimes wonder how much they're aware of their own, you use the word, complicity.
I think a lot of people don't want to think about their own complicity. I know it's hard for me. It's not comfortable, but it's also incredibly important. You know, we have the privilege of living in this beautiful place, and I think that comes with the responsibility to its original inhabitants. It's, you know, the people I think of as its forever stewards, the people who have always been here and the people who are always committed to this place, and that's the Duwamish people. And in the greater Seattle area and beyond, in the region, in Washington State, there are environmental challenges that are coming up, that are ongoing.
Alyssa, do you think your mind will ever not be colonized?
I don't know. I've never thought about that. I think there's a lot of talk about how to decolonize institutions, how to decolonize practices. And I don't really think that a complete decolonization of my thinking process is possible for me. And I don't think that that's really something that I'm necessarily working toward, because I'm trying to work toward other goals and other uses of my energy, like helping Native students to get graduate degrees, helping Native writers flourish and find opportunities for their work to reach readers. And I can do that without being a fully decolonized individual, luckily.
Seattle author Alyssa Washoda, telling you about the summer she spent in the control tower of the Fremont Bridge. It was part of an artist-in-residency program with the city's Office of Arts and Culture. And Washoda will present some writings from her time in the tower on Saturday, February 18th at Seattle Public Library Central Branch. This is KUOW's The Record. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. You know, the presidential election was so polarizing, our self-sorting so efficient, our bubbles so bubbly that if you didn't vote Donald Trump for president, you have probably had trouble understanding why anybody would. Well, before the election, UC Berkeley sociology professor Arlie Hochschild immersed herself with those soon-to-be Trump voters, spending 5 years among Tea Party members in rural Louisiana. And here's what she came up with. It boils down to a feeling, a belief. Hochschild calls it the deep story people tell themselves. And for Trump voters, it goes like this.
They're waiting in line, unmoving line of people that faces the American dream. They're waiting for the American dream, and the line isn't moving. And they've waited a long time. And they don't mean any harm to anybody, but they just want their due. And then, as they see it, as they feel it, some people come along that seem to be cutting in line. They see Barack Obama, who should be impartially supervising the entire line, who seems to them to be waving to the line cutters. It's okay. You know, I'm sponsoring you. And then they thought, well, gee, maybe he's a line cutter himself. And then they felt estranged. They felt, look, we're not even in this line. We don't count. We're not represented. And so they felt strangers in their own land looking for a new leader.
Since the presidential election, Arlie Hochschild has checked back in with those Louisiana voters, and she told me what they think now that Donald J. Trump is president-elect.
They think, well, you can't tell about him what he's doing. They're cautious about predictions. They see some chance that he'll say one thing and do another. But what they like so far is that he seems to be wiping the slate clean, as one man put it, starting with people who are experienced in the private sector. That's how they see it.
Has Obamacare come up?
Oh, they hate Obamacare, and they think he's going to get rid of it. Yeah.
Because we keep hearing how many Trump voters actually use Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act.
It's really interesting. Yes, and use other forms of welfare as well. They would tell me, can you turn the tape recorder off now? They were ashamed of it. There was one guy that was a Tea Party guy who was unemployed and on food stamps. And his Tea Party mother drove him to the place where he would shop for food.
That's interesting. So it's not so simple as what a bunch of rubes. They use the Affordable Care Act and they voted for the person who wants to repeal it. They're dupes.
It's not that simple. And they know that this looks screwy to liberals. They know what I call in the book the great paradox. You know, how could it be? But something else feels more important to them. And that something else is this deep story. They feel replaced and unfairly. Progressives will say, well, look, there really is a class war going on. It's between the 1% enriching themselves enormously and the rest of us, the 99%. That's where the tension line is in the social class system for progressives. But that's not where it is for the people I came to know in Louisiana. They felt the distance between them and the 1%. It wasn't of concern to them, as it is to me.
And regarding those voters' self-interest, you could argue that it's noble for your values, like justice, to outrank your personal financial need, and it's not a knock on you.
Yes. And they felt where the tension line for them was between they who worked hard and obeyed the rules and people that seemed to be on welfare. And when I say worked hard, there, one guy, the job he last had for the first 5 years, he got 1 week off the entire year. And that was sick time thrown in, too. So if you got a cold, you had no vacation for 5 years. And the next 5 years, he got 2 weeks off. So if you get a cold, he has 1 week off. Guy loves fishing. He never can get out there. And they did very dirty and dangerous work in some of these petrochemical plants. And so when they saw somebody waiting in line, someone wearing pearls or with done-up nails, this felt unjust to them when they imagined that they didn't work such taxing jobs, such long hours. They were actually an element of envy. Gosh, wish I could get that.
Wow. Well, was there much self-awareness of how others have had it worse than they have, especially what they've been gifted from their white ancestors?
No. And, you know, I went to the library and looked at some of the high school textbooks on Reconstruction and the Civil War and, you know, Jim Crow. What were they learning? You know, where did their truth on which the deep story rests, where did that come from? There's a northern and a southern version of Reconstruction in the years after and Jim Crow. And the southern version was used in high school texts up through the 1960s. It took the 1960s to change it and change it for everyone. And yet, here's the thing that I think liberals don't know. Liberals do know that there is racism and racist feeling. They do know that. What they don't know is that racism can take all kinds of forms and that white men don't feel like a privileged class. They feel, like the privilege of being white and the privilege of male didn't trickle down all the way. And this is a group that has a very high suicide rate, has a very high depression rate and rate of alcohol and drug consumption. I mean, it's not doing well. Blue-collar white men are kind of going the route that black men went from the 1960s onward.
And we can have a long conversation about that equivalency, too, as you well know. I'm talking with Arlie Hochschild, author of Strangers in Their Own Land, about the 5 years she spent getting to know Tea Party members, Republican members in rural Louisiana. I want your take on fascism. Some Democrats, as you know, fear that a significant number of the kind of Trump supporters you got to know won't stop at feeling a little more at home in their country. If their lives don't turn around, if those jobs don't come back, etc., they will turn on minority groups hard. What is your take from getting to know them?
I am afraid of fascism under Donald Trump, too. And I think we can look at history that fascism has been brought to a number of countries through the ballot box. And I think that we need to really prepare for it, look sharp, make sure to stop it at every turn, especially the freedom of the press. I don't think it's alarmist to use that word. And as a result, I may be answering not quite the question you asked, but I guess this is, seems to me the most important thing to say, is that we need to have one orientation toward Trump and his surrogates and what they do. And that is an orientation of defending democracy and freedom of the press and decency. And then we need another orientation to reach out to Trump supporters or people who have gone along with this. That's a different project.
But did you get the sense that those Trump supporters are fascist enablers waiting to happen? I mean, that's the connection,
see,
right?
Well, I think they're being taken for a ride. I mean, I think there are a lot of different, we have to differentiate, disaggregate, you know, probably five or six different types of people, and we could assign a proportion to each one. But I met a number of people who were appalled that he imitated a disabled reporter. And we just thought, well, what kind of human being would do that? And his groping of women, they were appalled by that. It isn't that they have no values and are all set to say Heil Hitler. They've been offered a kind of a bait, and they've taken the bait, and they're waiting to see what happened. And there are a lot of different kinds of people who are very decent, but who voted. A lot of Americans, what, 40% voted for him. They're not all proto-fascists. And we are really making a big mistake to presume they are. Oh, deplorables, just ignore them. You know, they need to be reached out to, and there are real grievances that the Democrats have not addressed.
Yes, you've written about how the Democrats need to address those differences. I'm wondering, we keep being told to reach out to people who disagree. Why? Why would your liberal friends who aren't any of those things in Berkeley or Seattle, what's so great about hanging out and getting to understand people who are going to make your head explode?
They'll make your head explode if you go into such occasions only with the purpose of reaffirming your own values and not for the purpose of understanding another viewpoint. And if you're such a person and you'd say, well, why do it? I would hurt. I think what you're doing is ignoring a growing split in this country that's going to come back and bite us all. It's not a good thing.
But is it realistic to ask the rest of us to bear the burden of those frustrating conversations?
I think it behooves us all in a moment like this. I don't think in my lifetime there's has been a political moment like this. I feel we're in danger. And to just go on and look at escapist movies and kind of ignore the newspapers and say, well, they're all racist, I have nothing to do with them, is a very mistaken step to take. I think we all have to look sharp. We all have to find ways to do what we can to make sure that the United States gets back on track and that we defend our democratic liberties. It's the wrong time to be passive. It's the wrong time to say, I'm so overwhelmed. And there are mechanisms for reaching out. And I don't think reaching out is the only thing to do. There are a lot of things to do. You know, you can up your dues to Planned Parenthood and NAACP. And, you know, there are things, the institutions that are soon to come under attack.
Well, when it comes to reaching out, you make a strong case. So for someone listening to you right now, what do you recommend?
Okay. I get on Google and Google living room conversations, and you'll come across the name Joan Blades, who is the co-founder of MoveOn.org. And she's starting a movement. I think there are about 100 different conversations going on today across the country, getting left and right together to see if we can find common ground. I'm about to do one. I have a Trump person, a single mom with two kids, who's going to come and stay with us in February, and we're going to engage in a living room conversation.
In Berkeley?
In Berkeley. You know why? She's for Trump, but her son would have voted for Bernie Sanders, 17-year-old son. And I said, no kidding. Good for you that you're handling it. They talk a lot, and it's quite of a model for how to handle great differences. And I said, well, where's he going to go to college? She said, well, he doesn't know. I said, well, come on to Berkeley. I'll show him.
How do you know when to stop trying? Is there a point where you stop trying, or is that just when you work all the harder to have to reach across?
You know, but it doesn't have to be one by one. I think through our churches, through our schools, through our labor unions, we can get movements to actually say, look, let's get a party out there that answers the needs for people that are being forgotten by globalization. Which party will it be? What are the policies we need in place? Get that going so there's a real alternative to Donald Trump.
I've been talking with Arlie Hochschild, who is Professor Emerita of Sociology at University of California of the Socialist Republic of Berkeley. And the book is the New York Times bestseller is Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. So good to talk with you again, Arlie. Thank you.
So wonderful to talk to you, Bill.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. ¶¶ If you recognize this song, you are probably a fan of the 90s television show Twin Peaks, the mysterious cult classic set here in Washington around North Bend. After two seasons, the show got canceled. It's been off the air for 25 years. This week, and if you're a fan, you probably already know this too, this week Showtime announced air dates for a new season of Twin Peaks. The network will air a new two-hour episode of the show in May. At least two more episodes will be available online immediately after that. A co-creator of Twin Peaks, Mark Frost, wrote a book to go with the new episodes of the show. It's called The Secret History of Twin Peaks. He told Jeannie Yandel why they first decided to set the show in the Northwest.
Number one, the Northwest hadn't really been depicted a lot in popular culture at that point. David Lynch had spent a good portion of his childhood living in that part of the world. We picked it because we thought it was appropriate tonally and thematically to the material that we were working with. And when we found the locations that we'd been looking for, we looked all over the Seattle area. And then that, I think it was the last day we were on our scout, we drove into the Snoqualmie Valley, and there it was. There was the old mill. There was the diner. There was the movie theater. It was almost as if it had been sitting there waiting for us. It was a lot of the locations that we'd put on paper were almost exactly as we'd described. It was really spooky, and we knew we'd found our town when we drove in. They've now had a kind of tourist boom in that area because that, to the world, is now Twin Peaks more than it is Snoqualmie or North Bend in a lot of cases.
Well, you got to come back to Washington State to film part of the new series. What was it like being back here after 25 years?
It was haunting, honestly. Most of us hadn't been back to the Snoqualmie Valley since we shot the pilot in 1989, 1990. And many of us hadn't seen each other, the cast and crew, and we had some of the original crew come back as well. So it was really a once-in-a-lifetime experience of going back to this place that we had really known quite intensely when making the pilot. And obviously, the place had lived on in people's imagination as this fictional town that they had a lot invested in. So to go back to those original locations meant many or most of them were still intact. And to be back with this same group of people, it was like a time machine. And a glorious kind of college reunion at the same time. Because when you go through something as intense as that original run of the show was with people, you bond with them in a way that's really hard to duplicate.
At the end of the second season in 1991, one of the characters on Twin Peaks says she'll be back in 25 years. I mean, was this your plan to come back 25 years later?
Accidentally. I mean, we were planning to come back in 4 months. You know, we thought we were going to have a third season. So we did a lot of work and a lot of storylines were laid out in relation to that. So some of the spade work had been done when we decided to bring it back. But also the discovery that that line was there made it a whole lot easier to justify the long wait or the long gap. I don't know that there's any precedent for a kind of continuing narrative like this to take a quarter century break. But, you know, why not try it? So that's what we did.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the universe that was created with Twin Peaks in the first place, that kind of mysterious, haunting feeling that was in the show that you've described kind of making the show, sort of the spookiness of finding a place that fit with what you imagined and the fact that it hasn't really changed much in a quarter of a century when you went back. Will that feeling, that sort of, I guess, insular, mysterious feeling continue with this new series?
Yeah, I mean, we're still talking about the same place. So there was a timelessness to the place. I mean, everybody commented on that at the time, that it seemed like it could have taken place in almost any decade. And it's always been my experience that when you go to smaller towns around the country, you're not going to see the bright, flashy things that come straight off the showroom floor in big cities that you're going to see when you go into those homes or those communities. You're going to find that the town has largely stayed the same over time. And I happen to think that the passage of time is one of the great themes in all of literature or drama, because we're all wrapped up in it. We're caught in it. We're in this slipstream of time that's carried us in our lives to this point, and we know where it's headed. So to watch characters go through that is a universal experience that I think really anybody can relate to.
What was it like creating that timeline for characters, seeing what had happened to them in 25 years? I mean, as you said, when we first started talking, initially you were all thinking about 4 months and then coming back. That's a huge break.
Yeah, and that was the challenge. I can't say too much about it because I don't want to give anything away about where we're headed. But the journey I took, having been sort of unstuck in time with the quarter century, I went in the different, in the opposite direction. I went back in time to find the origins of all these people and the kind of mysterious influences that formed the feelings that people got from the series in the first place. And in doing so, you know, you're able to kind of create a context larger than the one that the show itself was able to provide you, because the format of the written word is different and more expansive than what you can see on television. You can stop and think and ruminate and ponder what these things might have been. So the great joy for me in going back in time was finding out where all these things began and watching as the people that you knew in the show slowly start to come on stage with the passage of time, and you meet them as younger people and you take them through the course of their lives. That was a real joy creatively for me, and that was the appeal to me of doing the book.
I have to ask, Mark, you're talking about traveling back in time to tell origin stories for some of these characters and why they are who they are, and jumping 25 years forward to see where they are now. What is your favorite thing about the universe that you created with Twin Peaks?
Well, there's a thematic through line that kind of carries you through the book, and it's this idea of the role of mystery in human life that, for centuries, people just used religion to deal with that part of existence. They posited that there were supernatural beings or a being that was responsible for creation. And we're now living in a universe that's in many ways moved beyond that concept. And we're forced to confront, what are we doing here? You know, are we just people revolving around a sun on this rock in space, and it's a remorseless and different universe? Or is there meaning to it? Are we here for a reason? Mysteries, or in the Joseph Campbell sense of the word, mythology, has been what's always provided us with the sense that this all counts for something. And it invests life in its smallest and largest ways with things that provide meaning to us and richness and nurturing experiences, so that life is not just simply an endless string of consumer purchases, you know, that there's a richness to our inner life that I think we're all kind of grasping toward and hoping for. And that is one of the things I wanted to try to dive into with the book. What are the mysteries that sustain us and give us a sense of meaning that we can cling to, as opposed to secrets, which tend to be things that people use to withhold power and to wield it over others? And that dynamic tension between those two philosophies, I think, lies at the heart of what that region and this fictional town is all about, but also kind of the story of what our country is all about.
I'm curious to know what you're hoping new viewers will find in that tension you just described. What do you hope that they see in this, I guess, new chapter of this mythology you're talking about?
Well, it gets to the importance of narrative in people's lives, that there's a central part that narrative plays in the way we construct our own life story, the life story of our families and communities. And it's largely the way in which we both mark time and derive meaning by going through this lifespan that's, you know, the steps of which are pretty prescribed. It's the seven ages of humankind, as Shakespeare nailed it four centuries ago. So having had this long passage of time in the middle, that's automatically what the show is about. It's, to me, the greatest works of art are things that deal with the fact that we all age and die. And that gives urgency to living. And hopefully it gives you an impetus to live in the moment. I think that's what the best art reminds us of what we should do. It's It's something that I hope people will get from the show. That's more sort of in the deep background. I never try to direct people toward what they should get out of it. It's really up to them. But it's a joy to see a whole new generation come on board.
Mark Frost is co-creator of the iconic 90s TV show Twin Peaks. His new book, thank you, Bernard, his new book is The Secret History of Twin Peaks. As I mentioned, after 25 years, 9 new episodes of the program begin airing in May on Showtime.